Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 9th of July, 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me via video link today is Vanessa Bailey. Welcome to the programme, Vanessa.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, we're going to get straight on with Novichok 2, the sequel, because this continues. The Mail over the weekend had this, I think this was yesterday, had this breaking news: mother poisoned by Novichok is dead. Murder investigation is opened after woman infected with nerve agent by mystery item dropped by Kremlin assassins dies after heart attack. And the headline, the main headline, is killed by the Kremlin. And I just, Vanessa, I thought this was a spectacular headline because the blame is already assigned. Of course, this is subsequent to the G7 conference where Theresa May decided that rapid response was the right way to go, and assigning blame, no matter whether there's any evidence, is the way to do it. Now, thank you very much to Sheila Coombs and others who pointed this out to me. Before we get on to that, let's just talk about this, because the Mail describes the lady as a mother. Well, indeed she is, but that's not the full story, unfortunately, because as Sky News pointed out a few days ago, this was a quote from the Sky News article. Another friend of theirs who did not want to be identified told Sky News we're all pretty serious drug addicts, if they were withdrawing and it looked like heroin, they would have injected it straight away without a second thought. More and more clues that perhaps this was not Novichok at all, but perhaps a drugs-related issue. This is something that we highlighted last week on the programme, in fact, from the original Wiltshire Police Major Incident Report. And as they said, it was originally thought to be some kind of contaminated batch of drugs. And we were highlighting the similarities, if you remember last week, to the Skripal case itself. And this article from CSJ, response unit called the Salisbury Hospital declares major incident. And we were pointing out that this article had been changed. It originally said that fentanyl was the drug involved. There's the original version of the article. Now, they did not make clear when they updated the article why they updated it. I contacted this organization at the time and asked them why they'd updated their article without making it clear that the article had been updated, and they refused to respond. So thanks to Sheila and others for pointing this one out to me, because this is from the Swindon Advertiser on the 24th of January this year, before any of this stuff kicked off. And the headline is Doctors Warn of Super Strength Synthetic Heroin on the Streets of Wiltshire. And it says, doctors have been warned that super strength synthetic heroin could be circulating in Wiltshire. It comes after the discovery last month of a batch of heroin laced with fentanyl. Sometimes used as a prescription painkiller, the synthetic opioid comes from the same family of drugs as heroin, but it cannot be up to 50 times more potent. Only small quantities of the drug can be taken without potentially deadly consequences. Wiltshire police seized drugs contaminated with fentanyl on December the 19th from a 54-year-old Froome man arrested in Devizes. When it was tested by laboratory technicians, the 36 grams of brown powder was found to contain fentanyl, dimorphine, caffeine and paracetamol. So that was from the start of the year. And since then, we've had two alleged nerve agent attacks. And so why am I so skeptical that these were nerve agent attacks? Well, simply because as we've said many, many times, the response from the authorities is it's just absolutely incredible. So this is Public Health England, Mike Wade, saying our current advice based on the small number of casualties affected is that there's no significant health risk to the wider public. And Public Health England had put out an updated statement since the Skripal attack, saying wash clothing in ordinary washing machine using regular detergent at the temperature recommended for the clothing, wipe personal items with baby wipes, keep your items double bagged if they are for dry cleaning and so on. No hint as to, you should take your clothes to the dry cleaners. There's no hint of any problems for the people working in the dry cleaning establishments themselves. And this unbelievable advice followed up incredibly by Dame Sally Davies, the chief medical officer, said, "My advice for any individual, wash your clothes and wipe down any personal items, shoes and bags with cleansing or baby wipes before disposing of them in the usual way." And of course, the narrative in the mainstream media, schizophrenic to say the least, even within an individual, a single article, schizophrenic. And so the question has to be, which is it? Is it a deadly nerve agent which lasts forever and kills at a glance? Or is it a low-risk agent which can be washed away with everyday detergent and baby wipes? This is a very key question because, of course, if this whole thing is a fraud that's being used by the government to put pressure on the Russians, then, of course, people within the Wiltshire area are at risk from contaminated drugs, and these people are being rather cynically used by the British government for political ends. The very least that we can say, however, is that this Daily Mail article is absolute fake news. Vanessa, to me, this just looks more like a drugs-related issue which is being taken advantage of by the authorities. That might seem conspiratorial to many, but the facts don't stack up any other way.
Hi, Mike. My images seem to have frozen, so I don't know if they have your side. But an RTE report has just come in stating that Scotland Yard has said they can't identify the Novichok used as being the same as used in the previous Skripal incident. But I think what's amazing is how we have to look at the timing of this event. Yet another alleged chemical attack at a time when we have the Trump-Putin summit coming up. The US is discussing leaving the northeast of Syria. Those negotiations are allegedly ongoing with President Putin. And we know that the US proxy in the northeast, the SDF, are negotiating with Damascus. The liberation of the southern regions of Syria, the full liberation, are imminent. The majority of the armed factions down there, as far as I can understand, have surrendered after the US withdrew any support or assistance for those factions. And of course, we probably have the next military campaign, major military campaign, will be in Idlib, which is largely populated by the British government-financed white helmets and a sort of a plethora of armed groups and extremist factions, splinter factions from Al-Qaeda, etc. And within that region, UK aid has, of course, been providing millions of aid. Where to? We're not absolutely sure, but it's clear that a lot of that aid will have got into the hands of the militant groups that are there, the so-called moderate opposition that the British government is claiming to be helping and equipping with non-lethal aid. So there is a high risk to the British government, I believe, in what will be exposed after the liberation or after the military campaign in Idlib, particularly in Khan Shaykhun. So this has parallels to me of, in fact, Khan Shaykhun, when Tillerson had declared that Assad should stay, which was to the consternation of the British government. And within, I think, 24 hours of that, the White Helmets, who we know to be primarily funded and controlled by the British, had reported the alleged chemical attack in Khan Shaykhun, coincidentally. So I think, you know, there are a number of elements that are pointing towards this being, as you say, not to be conspiratorial, but there are a number of questions that must be raised over the timing of this event.
Absolutely, couldn't agree more. And I'm afraid your image has frozen at the moment. We'll wait and see what happens with that, but we may have to reset the connection in a second. But in the meantime, well, we'd be glad to know that Amesbury and Salisbury, clearly not dangerous enough to prevent the Home Secretary from going there. So Sajid Javid was there yesterday. Well, what did he have to say? It was a privilege to meet some of the first responders, and I want to thank them for the professionalism and dedication. We now need to allow the police to continue their investigation and so on. And really, why am I mentioning this? Because the point here, Vanessa, is that there seems to be parallels between the way that this whole story has been pitched from the beginning with the Skripals and moving forward, and the way that alleged chemical attacks are pitched in Syria. And again, we're highlighting first responders because that is the key. These are the key agents in the Syrian campaign, and we want to make sure that we keep those right at the forefront of people's minds.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the so-called first responders in Syria, the White Helmets, have been responsible for the production, at least of the narrative. My latest article at 21st Century Wire exposed at least one of the alleged chlorine attacks in eastern Ghouta during the campaign, the Syrian Army Liberation Campaign, to have been a staged event, according to testimony from civilians, but also according to the retraction from the Syrian interim government, the Western-backed shadow state institution that had occupied eastern Ghouta. So, you know, the White Helmets have been instrumental in pushing the chemical weapon narrative when it becomes necessary to increase the criminalization of the Syrian government and its allies.
Absolutely. Now, people starting to make fun of this whole thing, this being pushed around earlier today, really pleased to see people taking this type of action. So we've got a graphic here with an image of some hand cleanser. It's called Novichok, military grade Novichok, new improved formula with added defectol, and they're just making fun of the Conservative Party and Theresa May's narrative on this, and that's the way it should be. And as Vanessa's already mentioned, of course, the timing of this very significant with the Trump-Putin summit coming up in a few days' time. On Friday, the OPCW, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, released an interim report into the Duma alleged chemical weapons attack. And we've got to give credit to the Squawk Box, who seems to be the only people that I'm aware of that managed to capture the BBC's video news report. So let's just have a brief look at that.
The world's chemical weapons watchdog says that chlorine gas was used in an attack on the rebel-held Syrian town of Duma in April when dozens of civilians were killed. Britain, France and the United States responded with airstrikes. The Syrian government denies carrying out any chemical weapons attacks.
So that was what the BBC said on their video news programme on online, BBC Online. Well, we had to go back to the Wayback Machine to find out what they actually said on the 6th, which was Friday. And the headline then was Syria War, Duma attack was chlorine gas. And that they claimed that was according to the OPCW, strangely enough. The following day, the headline had changed, and this is the current headline, Syria War, possible chlorine at Duma attack site, according to the watchdog. So what was actually said? Well, here is the report from the OPCW Technical Secretariat. It was released late on Friday afternoon. And the quote, the key quote is this: the results of analysis of the prioritised samples submitted to the designated laboratories were received by the FFM team on the 22nd of May 2018, no organophosphorus nerve agents or their degraded products were detected, either in the environmental samples or in plasma samples from the alleged casualties. Various chlorinated organic chemicals were found in samples from locations 2 and 4, along with residues of explosive. These results were reported in Annex 3. Work by the team to establish the significance of these results is ongoing. Now, the key thing here is, of course, the chlorinated organic compounds could be anything. It could be for weed control. It could be for termite control. It could be for mosquitoes. It could be for any other insect that's considered to be a nuisance. So, Vanessa, the BBC, and we have to say others, but the BBC, a key player here, simply, lying. Could that be what's actually happened here?
Well, I think stretching the truth at the very least. But yeah, I mean, misrepresenting, certainly, and misinforming, misleading. I mean, the thing is that the BBC is quick enough to put out a clear and public apology to, for example, Israel when it makes a mistake in portraying possibly, how could it, the Palestinian people as the victims of Israeli oppression. But it's not as quick to put out an apology to the Syrian government for implying, as it has done from the 7th of April when this alleged attack took place, implying, one, that sarin was used, and now implying that chlorine was used, which is not what has been stated in the OPCW interim report. As you rightly say, those chlorinated elements could come from anywhere, including from PVC. Chloride is an element in PVC. PVC is used in a number of household items. Chlorine will be in the water, as it is in France and in the UK. So those trace elements, and they are trace elements, could come pretty much from everywhere. But the other important thing as well is that there was a lack of any sort of significant trace elements found even in the cylinder from swabbing the mouth of the cylinder and also from swilling water inside the cylinder. So, I mean, basically what the APCW has reported is that this chemical attack is highly contentious, and yet the UK government, the French government and the US government bombed Syria on the basis of a contentious report that came from open source social media chatter. And of course, guess who? The White Helmets.
I'm not aware. I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I've been following what the OPCW has been doing for quite some time now, and I haven't seen too many instances where they felt the need to produce an interim report. Generally, we have to wait for the final report to come out. And so I'm wondering why this interim report came out at all, actually.
Well, it particularly is, it certainly doesn't corroborate the foreign policy of a number of the major players in the supporters of the OPCW, let's put it that way. It's a hard one to call on this, because it certainly disappointed the likes of Bellingcat, Scott Lucas and a number of others, Idris Ahmed, who have obviously called chemical attack from the very beginning and blamed it entirely on the Syrian government, even before, as Peter Ford calls it, the dodgy dossier was produced.
I'm afraid we're going to have to do this again, because we've got to call these guys out. This is fake news, and there's really no excuse for it. Now, just before we move on to the next section, I just want to remind everybody that, Vanessa, you now have a Patreon page. So if anybody wants to support Vanessa's work, please get along to that, and you can make a small contribution there. How's it going with that, Vanessa?
Oh, it's going really well. And I'd like to put out a big thank you to all those who've already contributed. It just means that I can continue doing what I'm doing, independent of any sort of influential sponsors. And it's you that is helping me, so thank you.
Okay, and I'll echo that. Now, let's move on to this. This is a Guardian article. Sorry, I haven't got that labelled as such. How Syria's White Helmets became victims of an online propaganda machine. And we want to spend a few minutes just looking at the sort of machinery that is being built up to counter your work and also the work of Piers Robinson, Tim Hayward and Peter Ford and a number of other people.
Yeah, I mean, what is interesting is this was obviously the Olivia Solon Guardian article attempting to discredit all of those who are exposing the White Helmets as a non-governmental organization, as a sectarian organization, and as an organization that is embedded with extremist and terrorist factions inside, exclusively embedded with those terrorist and extremist factions inside Syria, largely dominated by al-Qaeda and their various splinter groups, but including Jaish al-Islam, who were the sectarian Saudi-financed occupiers of Douma in Eastern Ghouta, the scene of the chemical attack. And one of the main sort of go-to sources for all of these smear attacks, which include The Times, which really led a sort of intensified campaign, particularly against Professor Piers Robinson, Professor Tim Hayward, who obviously have spoken with me at Media on Trial. The go-to source for all of these articles to discredit journalists and academics alike is Professor Scott Lucas of Birmingham University. And here, in fact, we see, I think that was yesterday, Kubuk Almasyan of Syriana analysis, so a Syrian, was basically taken to task by Scott Lucas. And as Kavork says, that moment when a Western analyst who, to my knowledge, has never been to Syria, takes on a Syrian and accuses them of being a conspiracy theorist and of, heaven forbid, supporting his government and supporting his army against the invasion of NATO member state proxy terrorist forces.
Yeah, and you know, it is ridiculous. Scott Lucas pushing out, doing real journalism and analysis on Syria rather than pretending to be a journalist and issuing slogans about Western dudes and imperialism. But thanks for dropping by. But well, I don't even know where to start with that. But look, you know, we're focusing on Scott Lucas a little bit here, and so let's have a look at the sort of infrastructure that's around him at the moment. So here is Scott Lucas in the center here. What is Turan?
Well, Turan is a strategic study center that we believe was established in or just before March 2016. There's very little information about Turan on its website. And by checking the Wayback Machine, I can see that the first, saved section was in March 2016. Scott Lucas is a consultant at the Turan Center. Okay, that's not particularly surprising. Academics are often affiliated to research centers and to strategic study centers such as the Turan Center, which is based in Washington, D.C. and in Turkey. But what is interesting is when we started to look into the other researchers that comprise the Turan Center, starting with Asad Hanna, who, according to his own CV, his personal CV, is the media and advocacy manager of the White Helmets. He contributes to Chatham House, so an influential think tank affiliated to the British government, as we know. He contributes to TRT, the Turkish state media, and to the Washington Post. But he's also down as a researcher at the Turan Center. So even to begin with, we have a prominent White Helmet media and advocacy manager who contributes to a number of other NATO member state institutions whose objective is clearly regime change inside Syria. But then moving on, we have Dima Musa. Dima Musa was elected to be one of three vice presidents of the primary moderate opposition coalition, the Syrian National Coalition. She was elected to that post, having been a member of the Syrian National Coalition for some time, in May 2018. Now, of course, the Syrian National Coalition was an evolution from the original Syrian National Council that was supported by Hillary Clinton and by the NATO member states in their preferred option to President Assad from the beginning of the Syrian conflict. But again, we have a further connection between Dima Musa. In May 2016 to August 2017, she was the operations manager at Mayday Rescue. January 2013 to October 2014, she worked within the ARC group DMCC. Now, where this is interesting is during that time period, January 2013 to October 2014, James Le Mesurier, the ex-British military private security expert who set up the White Helmets, was also working at ARC group. And it's worth saying that Dima Musa's emphasis or focus was on the Middle East region while she was working for the ARC group. So it's, you know, it's not too conspiratorial to suggest that they may have worked together on the establishment of the White Helmets when James Le Mesurier was part of the ARC group. But then going forward, of course, in 2014, James Le Mesurier set up Mayday Rescue as an intermediary to take the funding from the British government Conflict Stability and Security Fund and to pass it on to the White Helmets. And at that point, Dima Moussa was the operations manager at Mayday Rescue between May 2016, August 2017. Sorry. And from various records and archives that I managed to find, she was very clearly involved in the support of the White Helmets, including handling and managing job applications for the White Helmets, etc. So there was a clear link here between not only the Syrian opposition, the primary Syrian opposition supported by NATO member states and by Gulf states, but also to the White Helmets. So again, connecting back also to Asad Hanna, who is White Helmets.
Just before we move on to the next section, Vanessa, we've also got the MEK logo on there. What's the connection?
Well, the connection, I haven't gone into this in huge depth, but earlier this year, Dima Moussa and other members, senior members of the SNC, were seen meeting with Mariam Rajavi and the MEK in France, at their headquarters in France.
Okay, we'll come on to that again in a little bit, but let's move on in down here, because SAC also connected to Tehran.
Yeah, again, I'm just putting this out there because these buildings where these organizations are based are vast. And I mean, this is in Washington, D.C., but at the same address, we find the Syrian American Council that has close connections to Arar Sham, one of the primary hardcore Islamist factions that is supported by the U.S. and EU member states in their regime change objectives inside Syria.
Okay, let's go in another direction then. And who's this?
Right, this is Majdi Nima. Now, Majdi Nima was, and I say was with a caveat, he was one of the leaders of Jaish al-Islam. Under his nom de guerre, Islam al-Lush, he operated as one of the primary military leaders of Jaish al-Islam. Now, Jaish al-Islam, of course, as I've just mentioned, was the group occupying Douma, so it was the group implicated in the chemical weapon narrative that has now largely been proved to be a little bit contentious by OPCW. And Jaish al-Islam carried out a number of atrocities against the Syrian people, including in Douma, the caging of civilians in November 2015, civilians, the majority of whom came from the Alawite minority sect. And we were told that many of those were afterwards executed. Now, they were caged as human shields against the Syrian Arab Army military operations. But Jaish al-Islam, we believe, also took part in the kidnapping of those victims that were caged in 2013 in Adra, to the northeast of Ghouta, where many of those civilians were massacred. Some of them were burned in the bread ovens in Adra. So Jaish al-Islam, who also ran the Al Tauba repentance prisons in Douma, which were used to imprison, again, minority sects, any Syrians that basically didn't adhere to their extremist ideology were imprisoned. And many of those, we believe, were executed before they could be released as part of the negotiations to surrender between Jaish al-Islam and the Russian Amnesty and Reconciliation teams in April 2018. So while Majdi Nima has claimed, I believe in September 2016, that he has quit Jaish al-Islam, as we see so often with the remodeling and rebranding of these groups, while they may put themselves under a different moniker, their ideology remains the same.
Okay, let's move on then to the next one. And who's this pleasant-looking gentleman?
So this is another researcher at Tehran. This is Captain Rashid Al-Hurani, although his name on Tehran is Rashid Hurani without the Al, but he's been identified as a previous leader of the Homs revolutionary movement. Now, this is interesting. So it's another armed militant, basically, focused on regime change inside Syria. But what is interesting here, he was part of the military arm of the Homs Revolutionary Council, which was founded by Farouk al-Habib, who is now the Syria program manager at Mayday Rescue. So again, we get a connection to the founders of and high-level members of the White Helmets.
Farouk appeared on the original network diagram that we did on the White Helmets.
Yeah, because as part of the Homs Revolutionary Council, because basically the councils, my understanding is that the councils were set up to siphon finance, arms, equipment to the armed groups that were affiliated to the council. So there was a very clear power structure there. So Farouk al-Habib, as a banker and a financier by trade, would have been in charge of the Homs Revolutionary Council that would then be responsible for the supply and transfer of arms, equipment, finance from the Western group, from the Western nations backing the so-called revolution in Syria. So the connection here is potentially very strong between al-Hurani, who is a researcher at the Turan Center, and Farouk al-Habib, who does not appear to have any direct connections to Turan, but who would have been connected to Hurani through the Revolutionary Council and the revolutionary movement.
Okay, and then we have Arar al-Sham. Well, how did Arar al-Sham collapse? We'll come on to that article in a second, but this group of people who are also linked back to that organization.
Yeah, I mean, basically, this article was written by one of the Turan contributors, Ahmed Abazaid, but it was revised by Professor Scott Lucas, which shows that Lucas is obviously having a hand in the information and in the studies that are produced and the research that is produced by the Turan Center. Now, Ahmed Abazaid equally has a very strong affiliation to Jaish al-Islam. In the photo that you showed on the diagram, he's standing next to Zaran Alush, who was the leader of Jaish al-Islam until he was killed in December 2015. And just by looking through Ahmed Abazaid's Facebook page, his social media accounts, we find again a very, very clear link to Jaish al-Islam and to Arar Sham. Now, here we have an image of Arar Sham fighters. Of course, Arar Sham is depicted particularly by the United States as a so-called moderate opposition force. It's one of the biggest armed Islamist forces in Syria, and it's sold as an opponent to ISIS and al-Qaeda, but there is on record the fact that Arar Sham up until 2014 worked with ISIS, and it has collaborated with Nusra Front at certain stages in its evolution. So again, you know, while we see a constant shape changing of these armed groups, effectively they are still extremist, sectarian, very brutal groups. I mean, Arar Sham was responsible, we can't forget that, for the massacre in Al Zara of minority sects in that town, I believe, in 2016. But the US has failed to designate them a terrorist organization, while Russia has been pushing for their designation as a terrorist organization for some time. And here we have, from Ahmed Abazaid's Facebook page, his eulogy to Zaran Alush, clearly showing that he has no problem with idolizing this sectarian group.
And these are the types of people that Scott Lucas is associating with?
Well, basically, I mean, these are the majority of the researchers and contributors on Syria to the Turan Center. So what we see here is, and the Turan Center is basically very much pushing its image as being unbiased, as being scholarly. So in other words, it's affiliating itself very much to the academic aspect that is brought in by Lucas here. Lucas himself, on a number of articles that he's written for, I believe it's a media outlet called The Conversation, has declared that his only affiliation is to Birmingham University. And yet here we have him, and I've had confirmation that he is still a consultant at the Torrens Centre from the Torrens Centre themselves. I actually messaged them on their Facebook page and they confirmed, one, that Lucas is still a consultant at the centre, and that Majdi Nima, the ex-Jaish al-Islam, is the go-to contact for information on financing and administration of the centre. I've also been told, although I haven't yet been able to verify this, but by reliable sources, that the primary funding for the Torrens Centre is Turkish, and that Toran means the mother of all Turkish people, the mother nation for all Turkish peoples worldwide. So there's a very clear Turkish link in this, and that also goes back to the Saudi link to Jaish al-Islam and the Turkish link to the funding of Arar Sham. So, you know, this would indicate, it would certainly indicate that Lucas is involved in an organization that is clearly biased, clearly partial, and that is effectively pushing research that will support the foreign policy of NATO member states, which is effectively regime change in Syria. And of course, that is backed up by Lucas's own position through his blog, EA Worldview, in which he clearly runs consistently an anti-Syrian government theme and a pro-armed faction theme. And, you know, we can find that through EA Worldview, his blog, and we can also find that through a number of papers that he's produced, both for his own university and for general academic use.
But as we can see here, you know, he continues to try to, well, he's being accused here of justifying and rationalizing putting civilians in cages for use as human shields. He doesn't seem to have any answers to this and puts out, you know, some pretty lame attacks in response.
Lucas doesn't do answers. Lucas just does deflection and distraction, basically, from his own appalling position, a totally biased position on Syria. Basically what he did here was to defend the use of civilians in cages as human shields, describing it as a necessary tactic carried out by Jaish al-Islam, without, of course, contextualizing the fact that Jaish al-Islam had been involved in a number of atrocities committed against the Syrian people, or the fact that the military campaign that these human shields were being used to deter was a campaign to liberate the eastern suburbs of Damascus from terrorist occupation, a terrorist occupation that had rained down 14,800 mortars onto civilians in Damascus city center during the period of its occupation. So, you know, what Lucas will do is to attack back against any sort of dissent or contradiction of his narrative with deflection, as I said, and with a counterattack. He has rarely honestly answered a question.
And just to finish this section off then, we have a number of images showing the MEK links. We're not going to go into any detail on this, but just tell us what we're looking at here.
I need to go into this in more detail. But basically what we see here is a clear collusion between the Syrian National Coalition. Sorry, there's been so many different forms of SNC, I have to remind myself. And the MEK, which is obviously, I mean, it was released from its terrorist label by Clinton and then again by John Kerry. It was allowed to establish itself in Albania. It has a headquarters in France. And here we see senior members of the SNC meeting with senior members of the MEK. And I do also have to note that Lucas is already starting to put out tweets regarding the Iranian regime and its inability to deal with the drought in Iran right now. So, you know, it may be a little premature to assume Lucas's position on Iran, but following the experience of his position on Syria, I would not be surprised to see him supporting regime change in Iran as we go forward. And certainly there seems to be a serious collusion between the SNC and the MEK.
Look, we've been focusing on one person here and the infrastructure around one person, but he's not alone in this.
No, and I think the main point here is, I mean, Lucas is to a large degree a bit player in this, as are many others, but what it highlights is really the infiltration of academic institutions in the UK with the potential to control a narrative on, in this case, the Syrian conflict, and to direct both students and public, because we have to remember that with his blog, Lucas is putting out a public sphere opinion. So he is also influencing, as far as he can, the public with his opinions and with his reports that are entirely based, I have to say, upon either armed factions inside Syria or, again, upon often the White Helmets and other affiliated assets and organizations financed and funded by the West operating inside Syria. I'd also like to really thank, if possible, while I can, Carmen Ranieri, who has been helping me enormously with this research.
Okay, Vanessa, thank you very much. Now we'll just close the program with a couple of other items, and of course the issue of Brexit continues to move along. David Davis decided last night that he would quit, and well, why? Because he didn't like the deal that Theresa May had put on the table at Chequers over the weekend. So we have the situation of, well, Brexit without the exit, it seems, because we're all going to move in the same direction. So let's just have a look at what was in this deal. Free trade. The UK and the EU are going to establish a free trade area for goods, apparently. And that's going to make sure that goods can pass through the borders without any problems. No problems with jobs, no problems with livelihoods. Well, what is that? I think it's called a single market. Okay, so nothing, no change there then. There's going to be a common rule book. So Britain's going to have a common rule book for things like food, for farming, for manufactured goods, which is going to shadow EU regulations. I think this is pretty much what we said was going to happen. So nothing changing there. The law, well, as we know, the Great Repeal Bill puts all the EU law onto the British statute books. But apparently Parliament is going to have the final say on future, incorporating future EU rules into UK law. And they will apparently be able to reject what they don't like, except of course they can't reject what they don't like if they want to take part in a free trade agreement or some, free movement of people. We'll come on to this in a second, because of course there's rules come with that. And if we break the rules, then we don't get access to the market. So same, Brexit without the exit, we continue. UK services apparently are going to get something special. They're not going to abide by the so-called common rule book. And this is going to allow the City of London to continue to do what it does without any hassle. And certainly the City of London very excited about that today. Of course, the EU hasn't agreed to it. They may not agree to it. So we'll continue as we're going. What else have we got here? Customs. Yes, of course, the customs issue is a problem with the Northern Irish border and so on. So the new customs union is going to be called the Facilitated Customs Arrangement. Sorry, that's fantastic. So the new customs union is going to be called the Facilitated Customs Arrangement, and it's going to be pretty much the same as what we've got. So again, nothing much changing there. Migration. Let's have a look at that one. Free movement will end, apparently, except that it won't. So nothing much to see there either. Of course, cash to the EU. We won't be paying £10 billion a year, whatever it is, to the EU anymore because, well, we won't be part of EU institutions except for the institutions that we choose to opt into. And then we'll have to continue to pay into those because we've opted into them. So nothing will have changed there at all either. So there you go. Brexit without the exit. We're getting more of a clue as to what that means. Well, David Davis has decided to resign as a result. I'd be very interested to see how much longer Theresa May can actually survive. And I suppose Boris Johnson will have something to say about that. And then just to finish off, a reminder that last week, Nigel Farage had said this. He was talking about the European Commission. He said, "You appear to be hell-bent on pushing for your European army, hell-bent for foreign policy without veto, and hell-bent to be on a direct collision course with President Trump and with NATO." And we said last week that while the first two are reasonable comments to make, that actually this issue of direct collision course with NATO is complete and utter nonsense, because Farage had gone on to say that the EU and NATO are incompatible, that they can't work together, that if the EU pursues unification of its military, that that will be cause problems with NATO. And the point we made was, well, that's absolutely not the case. That Federica Mogherini, the High Representative of the European Commission, and Jens Stoltenberg, the General Secretary of NATO, have been discussing this issue for several years, now at least 2 years, probably 3 years of negotiations on this. And well, the news came out today that tomorrow, in the run-up to the NATO summit, that Jens Stoltenberg will meet with Donald Tusk and with Jean-Claude Juncker at the Residence Palace in Brussels to sign a joint declaration on NATO-EU cooperation. This continues to develop, and we'll keep people posted as we find out more. But the fact of the matter is that NATO and the EU are absolutely in lockstep as the EU develops its military, its unified military structures. Right, we'll leave it there for today because we're absolutely out of time. Vanessa, thank you very much for joining me today. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. Thank you all for joining us, and hope to see you then. Bye-bye.